Inter Vestibulum by Pedro de Cristo, Contrapuntus, directed by Owen Rees. And that's a recent release on the Signum Classics label. They're singing in Antwerp tomorrow night, by the way. If you're heading for Belgium, it's probably worthwhile making a diversion. We're about to divert to the Royal Albert Hall. Just a reminder, tomorrow we'll be here at 4:30. Michael Rosen is bringing members of the Homemade Orchestra. Stephen Bell is joining me. Simon Callow is taking us inside Wagner's head. And Michael Ball will be singing for us as well, some Gershwin. What an eclectic lineup, as usual. Do join us at 4:30. But I'm BBC Radio 3 at 7 o'clock, and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. As you can hear, the excitement mounts. Over now to Louise Fryer.
Thanks, Sean. 2013 is a big year for anniversaries, not least the centenary of Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, recreated at the start of this season's proms. 10 days ago, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra gave us a complete performance of The Firebird, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Giuseppe Pons, conclude tonight's concert with Stravinsky's heart-rending tale of the puppet Petrushka. The prom begins with Stravinsky too, his Scherzo alla Russe, with the orchestra then handing over to the BBC singers for a couple of Stravinsky's unaccompanied settings of the Orthodox liturgy. Alongside Stravinsky, there's a German scene too. Violinist Frank-Peter Zimmermann is the soloist in Brahms' ravishing violin concerto, and singers and orchestra combine in the world premiere of a work written specially for them by the German composer Charlotte Zeiter, a BBC commission called The Language of Leaving. Stravinsky rekindled his Orthodox faith after leaving Russia around the time of the revolution. Though he never spoke publicly about his beliefs, while living in exile in France in the 1920s, he attended services almost daily, perhaps to forge a nostalgic connection with his distant homeland. In the following year, he wrote settings for parts of the Orthodox liturgy, including the Lord's Prayer, Otče náš, in Church Slavonic, and the well-known prayer to the Virgin Mary, the Ave Maria, Bogorodica Devo. They're instantly recognisable as the work of Stravinsky, with that same ritualistic, implacable, highly rhythmic quality that can be heard in his other music of the period. But for all that, you can also hear clearly that they draw on a long tradition of Orthodox chant. Stravinsky draws on Russian folk song for the opening work in the concert, his Scherzo alla Russe, written originally for the Paul Whiteman Orchestra after Stravinsky had settled in Los Angeles in the 1940s. He rescored it for symphony orchestra a couple of years later, using his unrivaled skills of orchestration to recreate some of the folk instruments of his native Russia. That applause is for the guest leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra this evening, Simon Blendis. And the BBC singers are gathered behind the orchestra. They're at the top tier on the risers, under the bust of Sir Henry Wood. And we're waiting now for the Catalan conductor, Josep Pons. He's making his proms debut here this evening. And for much of the time, he's music director at the Liceu in Barcelona. And here he comes to start off this prom with three short pieces by Stravinsky, beginning with the Scherzo alla Russe. the words of the Ave Maria and then the Lord's Prayer in Church Slavonic, set by Stravinsky and sung by the BBC singers, following the BBC Symphony Orchestra's opening Scherzo alla Russe. Two very different sides of the Russian composer, Giuseppe Pons, conducting for the first time here at the BBC Proms. Tim Murray, the chorus master of the BBC singers. Well, the orchestra will be returning to Stravinsky at the end of the concert for his ballet Petrushka in the version he created around the same time as the Scherzo alla Russe that opened the concert in 1947. You might notice a certain musical similarity. For now, though, a work that unsettled the critics at its premiere in 1879, Brahms' Violin Concerto. They claimed it was really a symphony in disguise, written, as one put it, against the violin. Brahms had been on a trip to Italy and on his way back stopped off at a little village on the Wörthersee in Carinthia, a place where he'd composed his second symphony the year before. He wrote to a friend, "I only wanted to stay there for a day, and then, as this day was so beautiful, for yet another. But each day was as fine as the last, and so I stayed on. The mountains round the blue lake are white with snow, while the trees are covered with delicate green." Earlier, I spoke with our soloist, Frank Peter Zimmermann, and asked how Brahms' music was influenced by those surroundings.
It has a very special atmosphere, a typical Austrian idyll, lake in the mountains, and he spent some summers there to compose probably his sweetest, most amabile music he ever wrote.
It's sometimes criticised because you don't get a big starry role as you do in some romantic concertos. Do you mind that?
I don't mind it at all. I mean, it's a symphony with some violin in it. No, it's a real violin concerto, but definitely it's like the big German romantic classic concertos. The violin is really inside the orchestra and comes out of it. But I think the violin has enough to play, and it's fantastic to take part in this adventure every time. I have been playing this since 1983, so it's 30 years ago when I first played it with orchestra. And since then, maybe I played it 120, 130 times in my life, all over the place. And it's never getting boring. It's such a great, great masterpiece.
Frank Peter Zimmermann, our soloist this evening. Well, Brahms composed the piece for his friend Joseph Joachim, the two liaising closely, and Brahms left the cadenza for the soloist to supply. Frank Peter Zimmermann has chosen to play Joachim's original cadenza. He'll be using the Stradivarius that dates from 1711 that used to belong to Fritz Kreisler. And he was joking earlier that he should be playing Kreisler's cadenza, as the violin would play it all by itself. Well, it has to be said that though Brahms liaised with Joachim, he generally ignored the violinist's technical advice. He originally sketched out the concerto in four movements, very much in the symphonic style, but ended up with a classical three-movement form, beginning with a long orchestral introduction. The middle movement is slow and lyrical, and the finale is a light-hearted allegro, reflecting Joachim's Hungarian roots, Brahms' own early interest in Hungarian music, and a general feeling of well-being. And as I say, Frank Peter Zimmermann will be using his Stradivarius that belonged to Kreisler. When Kreisler sold it in 1946, it made the papers. It's now known as the Kreisler. It used to be called the Earl of Plymouth because, having been lost for 175 years, it was discovered in the Earl's attic in 1925. Kreisler himself acquired it a few years later. That was after a few hurdles. He'd always dreamed of owning a Strad. He tracked one down in a New York music shop. It was more than he could afford, but by the time he got the money together, the instrument had been sold to a collector. He went to see him, tried to buy the violin, the man refused, but let him play it for a few minutes and was overwhelmed by Kreisler's playing, and he changed his mind. We can hear just how that violin sounds now in Brahms' Violin Concerto, Frank Peter Zimmermann, the soloist. A warm embrace between conductor and soloist Frank Petter Zimmermann. The Brahms Violin Concerto in D Major, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra in this prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. And Giuseppe Pons, the conductor, bringing the principal oboe Richard Simpson to his feet. And now together with the rest of the orchestra, the guest leader Simon Blendis. Giuseppe Pons making his debut as a conductor at the proms this evening, applauding Frank Petter Zimmermann and shaking hands with the leader and co-leader. That piece premiered by Joseph Joachim in Leipzig on New Year's Day 1879, the Hungarian feel of that final movement. Only a homage by Brahms to Joachim's own concerto in a Hungarian manner, which he dedicated to Brahms. Frank Petter Zimmermann has recorded most of the major concerto repertoire. He's given the world premiere of plenty of pieces, including Augusta Reed Thomas's concerto, Juggler in Paradise. And here he comes now. The Brahms audience hugely enthusiastic, as you can hear, after each movement, desperate to applaud this player, and now given free rein. He's a keen performer of chamber music too, joined by Antoine Tamestiet and Christian Poltera in Trio Zimmermann. They won 5-star reviews for their concert at the Edinburgh Festival last year. And Frank Petter was up in Edinburgh this weekend to perform the concerto we've just heard with the Zurich Turnhalle Orchestra. He's currently their artist in residence. He's coming back onto the stage now together with Giuseppe Pons, each applauding the other. And Giuseppe Pons putting a warm arm around Frank Petter Zimmermann's shoulders and then stepping back to allow him to take the spotlight. He was born in 1965 in Duisburg in Germany. He started playing the violin when he was 5 years old, giving his first concert with an orchestra at the age of 10. I wonder if he ever dreamed that he'd one day perform as a soloist all over the world with a Stradivarius belonging to Fritz Kreisler clamped under his chin. And he's smiling modestly as he comes back to take yet another bow. We're going to have an encore. Thank you. Music by Bach, the prelude from the third partita, BWV 1006, an impromptu encore for Frank Peter Zimmermann. I'm glad he remembered to tell his wife a bit late in the day that it was a 7 o'clock, not a 7:30 start to this prom. She wouldn't have wanted to have missed his triumph here on stage at the Royal Albert Hall. All the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra applauding him as he comes back, grinning a little sheepishly, but evidently delighted with his reception here. I was saying he's premiered plenty of new works, including Brett Dean's The Lost Art of Letter Writing and Ancien Dean by Matthias Pincher, who incidentally made his debut at the Proms this season, conducting a concert with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra just 10 days ago. Stravinsky was on that programme. It's on this programme too. In 20 minutes, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be returning to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, joined by the singers for the world premiere of The Language of Leaving by Charlotta Zeiter, and the concert ends with Stravinsky's colourful Russian ballet Petrushka. But now, during the interval of tonight's prom 20 minutes, next month, Radio Times will be celebrating 9 decades of continuous publication. To mark the moment, broadcasting historian Simon Elms has been leafing through the yellowing pages to discover how the magazine has reflected British musical life over the years in The Music of Radio Times.
When there's something important to announce, Radio Times, just like any newspaper, has always put it on the front page. And so it was that on May the 27th, 1927, the already hundreds of thousands of readers of what then was Britain's only periodical dedicated to listing radio broadcasts declared,
"British listeners have welcomed the news that Sir Henry Wood has been engaged by the British Broadcasting Corporation to conduct a number of special concerts."
It was the start, no less, of the Association of the Proms, and it surprised me to learn that in that dinner-jacketed wireless world they were quite regularly called proms, not promenade concerts, with the BBC.
The Proms, which since 1895 have been the most popular series of concerts in London, were for various reasons to have come to an end last year,
ran the masthead a few weeks later for the August the 13th listings.
However, by arrangement with the BBC, it has been found possible to continue the series. The 32nd season opens tonight at the Queen's Hall under the baton of Sir Henry Wood. And what could be more suitable to open the Proms, that unique element of London life, than Cockaigne, a picture of the bustling, cheery, noisy existence of the town of the Cockneys, with romance bravely threading its way through the clatter.
And as for Bach, Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms, they're not dry as dust names to be shuddered at these days. They've become friends now, and well-loved friends, to all sorts and kinds of people who'd never have heard of them till the Proms started.
Sir Henry Wood himself, speaking in 1941, just 3 months after the Queen's Hall, which had housed the Proms from the start, and which stood barely 100 yards from the BBC's London home in Broadcasting House, had been gutted by fire. On May the 10th, it was hit by a German incendiary bomb. London's finest concert acoustic was no more, though a bust of Sir Henry did survive among the rubble. Back when Radio Times first appeared, 90 years ago, it already was a substantial journal. Edition number one, the official organ of the BBC, as it proudly proclaimed itself, had a solid wodge of articles to bulk out the prosaic lists of vocal and organ recitals, military band performances, chamber and orchestral concerts, sprinkled with the occasional worthy talk and news bulletin. "Hello, everyone," proclaimed Director of Programmes Arthur Burrows on the cover, dated September the 28th, 1923. "We will now give you the Radio Times, the good new times, the Bradshaw of broadcasting. May you never be late for your favourite wave train."
"This is London calling. As the Radio Times has now made its appearance and will give you full particulars of the week's programmes in advance, this will be the last of my Saturday night talks on coming events from 2LO.
Which was what the London station of the BBC was then called. Radio Times's first editor, Leonard Crocombe, was also in charge of the popular magazine Titbits, and from the start the new publication offered a similar eclectic mixture of wireless odds and ends. The miracle of broadcasting, the choice of a receiving set, photographing wild animals by Major A. Ratcliffe Dugmore, FRGS. And of course, with music accounting for the vast proportion of the hours broadcast each week, it inevitably found its place in the magazine too. Literally, page 16 of that first edition was completely devoted to the score of Across the Bridge of Dreams, a song that had won a £100 prize in a recent wireless competition.
The bridge of dreams I built for you is made of memories dear. The bridge of dreams is love come true. It brings you always near.
Yes, well, perhaps not. Leafing forward a page, and Stanton Jeffries, the BBC's musical director, was writing about some of the lighter musical moments that had already been clocked up by the fledgling BBC in its first tiny office.
Yes, there I sat while engineers tested microphones, a typist clicked away morning, noon and night, and streams of artists poured in begging for engagements.
Like the concertina player who turned up for an audition at the wrong moment when the staff were in turmoil.
He somehow became submerged in the general excitement, hurry and bustle, and was discovered some 20 minutes later by an experimental engineer still giving soulful utterances on that most soulful of soulful instruments.
Broadcast performances could be wayward too, as the magazine's second edition demonstrates, with a facsimile reproduction of a postcard from an irritated music lover.
In memory of Tannhäuser,
it reads in scrawly capitals,
murdered by the London Wireless Orchestra, 19th of September, 1923.
In its first years, Radio Times, just like radio itself, was very much learning what it was supposed to be as what we'd now call a listings magazine. There wasn't, at first, very much in the way of photographs. And in fact, some of the brightest and most eye-catching pages were those advertising TMC loudspeakers, the Gecaphone, Polar Peanut Valves, Amplion, Marconiphone, Radiola wireless sets, Mullard valves, and Etherphone broadcast receivers.
Let broadcast brighten your home.
By March 1925, the layout was becoming more popular and less reminiscent of something found in a dull Edwardian smoking room. People You'll Hear Next Week was a photo spread featuring brilliant harpist Sidonie Goossens alongside a shot of Sir Edward Elgar and assorted recitalists. In fact, Sidonie Goossens was a favourite whose glamorous publicity shot regularly adorned Radio Times' picture pages.
No musical diehard in defence of an all-male orchestra could sustain his case against the claims that could be made on behalf of Miss Sidonie Goossens.
Mid-20s, 24 actually to be precise, I was already playing with the old wireless orchestra then, which was conducted by Percy Pitt, who was a very well-known operatic conductor in the wireless orchestra and the 2LO orchestra. I was only just called in when they needed a harp. And at that time I was freelancing with all the other orchestras.
Astonishing that Sidonie was still putting in an appearance at the proms at the age of 92 and died only a mere 9 years ago. From its inception, the BBC's founding principles, as laid down by John Reith, its first Director General, were familiarly to educate, inform and entertain. Meanwhile, one of Reith's lieutenants, the brilliant Cecil Lewis, formalised the new institution's guiding ideas, not least of which was to keep broadcasting on the upper side of public taste. And here, classical music was in the vanguard. What was, to modern ears, uncomfortably called good music was part of the warp and weft of the BBC from the beginning. And those educational and good taste aspects of broadcasting quite naturally spilled out into the pages of Radio Times too. Percy Scholes, legendary compiler of the Oxford Companion to Music, was Radio Times' music commentator, and he was deeply committed to spreading the word. Up to the present, he wrote in an early edition, the great music of the world has been the private preserve of a little band of people who happen to live in the places where it could be heard and who happen to have the money to pay to hear it. Henceforth, it belongs to everybody. From 1923 until the outbreak of the Second World War, the discussion of highbrow and lowbrow music was one that endlessly filled the columns of Radio Times with, frankly, exhausting regularity.
Lowbrows in music are like lowbrows in literature,
Scholes complained.
Life to them is a matter of A, business, and B, amusement. Life to us highbrows is a matter of business and amusement too, but we extend the latter term and don't mind occasionally applying our minds to our entertainment as well as to the task of earning a living.
Scholes, showing he had teeth when it came to taste. More fun were the music articles that captured both the high aspirations of the good music panjandrums and the day-to-day realities of ordinary listening, or listening in, as for years it was known. Like this one, entitled Socks and Sonatas, in which Robert McGill reported from the domestic hearth, very unliberated back in 1926, about the way his wife tackled tasks while listening to the wireless.
I came home the other day to find my socks being darned to a sonata. The andante con variazioni was too slow, with the result that the stitches were too bold. But later, in the syncopated passage, my wife missed a beat and stuck a needle in her finger.
And McGill has some inventive thoughts about making this example of 1920s multitasking rather less hit and miss.
Thus we could have a jumper night when lively ballet music would assist the click of those glittering needles in their knit one, purl one, drop three. Why can't one of our younger composers write a miniature suite, especially for the radio, based on the instructions that are found in the dressmaking papers? On Monday evenings, when most of us are exhausted by the beginning of the week's work, we should appreciate a symphony suitable for nursing the cat, including that animal's purr in the bass. But on Friday night, pay night, we should prefer Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance.
We tried to do what we thought was right about good music. You see, I was brought up in a world of no music at all, really. I didn't hear a symphony orchestra till I was 20, having been born and brought up in the country. And there was no radio, the gramophone was in its infancy and so on. Here did seem to be the opportunity to give everybody fine music, and I think we've done it.
Kenneth Wright, one of the early directors of music at the BBC.
Time was when the old farm was as quiet as the moor that surrounds it on all sides,
writes Margaret Lonsdale in May 1927 under the headline Chopin on the Farm.
No sound was to be heard but the clucking of the fowls in the farmyard, the softly lowing cows and the rattle of milk churns on the dairy floor. Then, Farmer Hodges, having at last heard tell of this ear wireless, had a set installed, and the farmhouse woke to life. Here was a rival to the weekly concert provided by the farmer's wife, who Sunday by Sunday sat down at the cottage piano with a row of departed relatives rattling in their frames above her, and plodded through half a dozen hymn tunes. But now, along with kings in their castles and rich men relaxed comfortably in easy chairs, each Sunday afternoon will find her listening under her thatch, a significant fact of our democratic age. "Ye be just too late," she says with a touch of pride when her husband comes in late from the fields. "A gentleman's been playing that there impromptitude in A. Just lovely it were."
The new music debate, likewise, was played out big time in the pages of the very musical early Radio Times. "Is Bartok mad, or are we?" was the headline to a provocative article in December 1927 by the redoubtable Percy Scholes.
Before I go further, let me set everybody's mind at rest. To the best of my belief, the answer to that question is neither.
But clearly, popular taste lagged somewhat behind the musical connoscenti like Scholes, because a wonderful pocket cartoon by Gully to accompany the article features three listeners in various states of anguished disarray, hands to head, hair standing on end, and one prostrate on the floor, with the words clatter, crash, emerging from the horn of a radio. Bartok how funny it seems today, was clearly a red rag to the traditionalist bull. Because a couple of years later, in the listings for March the 4th, 1929, a boxed-off headline proposes programmes to suit the whole range of musical tastes.
You take your choice between the music of Béla Bartók and Herman Finck in the programme tonight. Bartók, the idol of the moderns, will play his own compositions in the contemporary music concert relayed from the Arts Theatre Club at 8. Those who do not like ultra-modern music will have their turn at 9:40, when Herman Finck will conduct the Wireless Orchestra in a programme of his own music.
Herman Finck?
Finck has long been held in warm affection as purveyor of bright and tuneful pieces which have no other object than to entertain us.
The same day's programming, incidentally, included a discussion of should there be a Channel Tunnel, a talk in French, and even more bizarrely, a programme devoted to, of all things, a hand at auction bridge. And who said that juggling on radio was daft? Reith's BBC's laudable foregrounding of classical music for the masses continued throughout the 1930s, and Radio Times continued likewise to support the programmes with a steady flow of prominent articles. You have to imagine, though, the desperation that successive editors must have gone through as the now hoary debate about highbrow versus popular music was churned over again and again. But thankfully, there was always room for articles by the literary greats of the day. Compton Mackenzie contributed a suitably refreshing seasonal memoir for an August the 2nd edition of Wet and Windy Summers Past, under the headline, Were Bygone Summers Always Sunny? And Sir Cheverel Sitwell, in a really beautiful piece, similarly gave Radio Times readers a glimpse of his childhood, truly sun-drenched this time, and musical.
The year must have been 1904. My family had taken a villa at San Remo and we went over to Monte Carlo for lunch. I found myself alone with my nurse listening to Casse-Noisette. I'd never heard anything so beautiful and remained absolutely spellbound. I'd never been abroad before. The new kinds of flowers, the oranges, the lemons, the palm trees, the heliotrope, the jasmine, all these things seemed to be interpreted by the music. The Valse des Fleurs was the apotheosis, and its strains rang in my ears for months to come.
But to end with, back to the proms, and some lovely, lively writing by Walter Rolt. He was an occasional Radio Times contributor who liked to think of himself as a sort of everyman in the street. And it was, inevitably, back to that highbrow, lowbrow thing again. A Plain Man at the Proms, it was called, and it begins in high good spirits.
The proms are lots of fun. It's nice to watch Sir Henry Wood crouching low to the side of his desk to pluck soft music from a double basses and then to admire his titanic gesture as he hurls the whole orchestra up in a tremendous burst of sound.
But by the end of the article, though not of the concert, this particular plain man is slipping away as the audience are returning from the bar at the end of the interval.
It's a great show, certainly, and one which fills one with respectful awe. It almost feels a shame to come away before the end, especially as there is always the bar. But across the road is a cinema. It's showing Buster Keaton in College. Attaboy, let's go.
As the 1930s darkened into war, the BBC was evolving. Radio Times started listing television programmes in 1936, which absorbed, of course, precious space in the magazine. In 1938, Reith's reign ended, by which time a shorter digest for the music lover had taken the place of much of the expansive musical coverage. And when hostilities actually started, the page numbers were cut to a bare 20. Just as Britain's sumptuous gardens were being dug up to grow vegetables for the war effort, Radio Times's glorious and colourful artwork that had so often adorned the cover was now abandoned to be replaced with plain utilitarian copy. Ralph Hill compiled a regular column on broadcast music, but it too shrank by the fourth year of the war to a ration book, Ralph Hill's Music Article. Space, after all, was required for copy like Winning the War on Bread and Cheese and for stirring articles on The Land We Defend. After Henry Wood's beloved Queen's Hall had been bombed, the proms moved to the much larger Albert Hall. But in the summer of 1944, as Sir Henry prepared to conduct his 50th anniversary season, V2 rockets were menacing London, and the concerts took refuge in Bedford.
Although this studio concert, marking the end of the 50th season of proms, will be very different from the usual final night at the proms, the general character of the programme will help to give the occasion a sense of fitting climax.
That concert was broadcast on August the 10th, 1944, but Wood, already seriously ill, didn't make it onto the rostrum. 9 days later, he was dead. Well, the interval in tonight's prom is nearly at an end, and the audience are indeed easing back into their seats, so I'm going to join them. No Buster Keaton showing in Kensington tonight to lure me away. But before I go, a couple of pieces of erudite musical humour from the Radio Times archive, or is it perhaps humorous erudition? Limericks, anyway. In 1930, the magazine, which next month notches up 90 glorious years of weekly publication, brought readers a whole page of winners from a competition it had been running for broadcasting themed limericks. And inevitably, I suppose, the pleasures and pains of new music came under the spotlight. Pianist Harriet Cohen gets a name check, as does Arnold Bax, who had the previous year completed his third symphony.
There's an English composer called Bax who has written enough to fill Sax. When H. Cohen and he play his last symphony, we whistle the tune that it lacks.
The editor, punctilious as ever, pointed out that symphonies usually don't have pianists, but craved readers' indulgence. But my own favourite returned, equally inevitably, to the anguished debate that had raged through the music pages of Radio Times pretty much from its first edition. Good music versus popular music. Oh, no.
I am a listener, oh yes, and highbrow. And that is the reason I sigh now, for jazz is the rage in this decadent age, which elevates naught but an eyebrow.
Raising the brow level in the music of Radio Times were readers Joanna Brooks and Michael Burtonshaw. The programme was presented and produced by Simon Elms. I'm Louise Fryer. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. And there's new music still to come in tonight's prom that sees conductor Joseph Pons making his prom's debut here with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and the BBC Singers. Stravinsky takes us to a Shrovetide fair in St. Petersburg in around 20 minutes, as seen through the eyes of the puppet Petrushka. That's after the premiere of a brand new work by the German composer Charlotte Zeiter, interweaving the voices of the BBC Singers with the instruments of the orchestra. The piece is called The Language of Leaving, and it's based on fragments of a poem by a 17th century Italian poet, Francesco da Lemene. I asked Charlotta about the text and why she chose to interpret it through vocalisation rather than word setting.
It was absolutely clear that it was not my way of mimetic following of the poem. This is something which does not interest me so much at the moment, because I want to be more free. If I follow a poem like this, the author of the poem makes the decisions. So I decided to find another method for myself, which I just use now since 10 years. I just use the phrases which I need. So the music is the important thing. The message of the music is the message of the music. And some things of the text are as well the message of the music. But the music is much more than only the semantics of the text. There's a special quality of the singers I like very much, and it is that they are able to sing like a flute, like a violin, like an instrument. And this is a special way of British choirs. And so I decided, well, if the choir has this quality, I would like a lot to integrate them into the orchestra and really to behave them like a flute, to behave them like a trumpet, to behave them like a double bass. And I would like to have that at the end of the piece, the difference between voices and instrument is forgotten, because you just feel the language of leaving.
Charlotte Zeiter. When I was talking to one of the BBC singers earlier, she's really been enjoying getting to grips with this piece. The voices are there to sound like echoes or shadows of the instruments, which particular one connected by a dotted line in the vocal score. And vocal techniques include voiceless whispering without pitch, producing vocal harmonics, and imitating the sound of the Waldteufel, a forest devil, a small percussion instrument also known as a frog caller, a little like a wooden drum, small enough so it fits in your palm with a nylon string passing through the drumstick, the other end attached to a wooden stick so you can pull the string taut and tweak it to create a loud rasping sound at various pitches and intensities. All four percussion players have their own, as well as plenty of other instruments at their disposal. Swanee whistles, a wooden organ pipe, thunder sheets, temple bells that are bowed rather than struck. All in all, it's a fascinating sound world. And coming on to the platform to conduct it, Joseph Pons, joining the BBC Singers and the BBC Symphony Orchestra for The Language of Leaving. This is the world premiere of Charlotte Zeiter's new piece. New music, always such a feature of every prom season. That was the world premiere of The Language of Leaving by German composer Charlotte Zeiter. She's here in the hall. She's just making her way down onto the stage. Joseph Pons conducting the BBC Singers and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And embracing the composer, giving her a kiss on each cheek. There's last few fragmentary phonemes given to the women of the BBC Singers, though some of the men were singing falsetto at one point. Silently fluent is one of the more intriguing markings in that score. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra have given the first UK performances of several of Charlotte Zeiter's pieces, including Pairs d'Alternance and Music for Orchestra. They've really introduced her to audiences here in the UK. She started out as a musicologist, her abilities as a composer spotted by her theory teacher in Berlin. Vocal music, very much a passion of hers. She's even written a one-woman opera for voice and hand percussion. She's coming back onto the platform now together with Tim Murray, the chorus master for the BBC Singers. And he's applauding her and encouraging his singers to stand as Joseph Pons, directly behind him, is bringing the orchestra to their collective feet. You can find out more about Charlotte Zeiter straight after this prompt. She's the subject of this evening's composer portrait, talking to Andrew McGregor. That's at 9:30. So there are plenty of string harmonics as well as vocal harmonics in that piece, the kind of thing Stravinsky made use of, as well as colourful orchestration in his first ballet, The Firebird. His follow-up, Petrushka, is the final work in this BBC prom live from the Royal Albert Hall, recreating in sound all the bustling action and raucous entertainment of a Russian fair, earthy and full of character, designed to tap into the passion for Russian exoticism that infused Paris 100 years ago. Stravinsky's original idea for Petrushka was to make it an orchestral piece in which the piano would play the most important part. In his chronicle, Stravinsky wrote, "In composing the music, I had in my mind a distinct picture of a puppet suddenly endowed with life, exasperating the patience of the orchestra with diabolical cascades of arpeggi. The orchestra, in turn, retaliates with menacing trumpet blasts. The outcome is a terrific noise which reaches its climax and ends in the sorrowful and querulous collapse of the poor puppet." Stravinsky decided to base the character of the puppet on Petrushka, a Russian combination of Commedia dell'arte's Piero with the English Mr. Punch. But following his success with The Firebird, composed for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, it was the impresario who realised the dramatic possibilities of the piece. Diaghilev persuaded the composer to concentrate on the tragic aspect of the story and develop Petrushka into a ballet consisting of 4 burlesque scenes. In case you're not familiar with the story, it's set at the Shrovetide Fair in St. Petersburg in the 1830s, with crowds of people thronging the stalls and sideshows. Stravinsky incorporates Russian folk tunes and accordion motif, a couple of tunes for hurdy-gurdy, the first taken from a popular Russian chanson, the second from a French music hall ditty whose title roughly translates as "She Had a Wooden Leg." In the middle of the hustle and bustle, there's a little theatre where a showman presides over 3 puppets, a Petrushka, a ballerina, and a Moor. The showman charms them with his flute, and the puppets take on lives of their own with all too human feelings. They act out a classic love triangle. Petrushka, conscious of his grotesque appearance, falls in love with the pretty ballerina. She, of course, opts for the handsome, brutish Moor. Stravinsky used a Christmas trip to St. Petersburg to gather material for the final tableau depicting the fair at its height. He wrote to a friend, "The final scene is shaping up excitingly. Quick tempos, concertinas, major keys, smells of Russian food, cabbage soup, and of sweat and glistening leather boots. It's evening, there are dancing wet nurses, coachmen, even a bear. But the festivities are interrupted as Petrushka rushes out of the theatre with the Moor in hot pursuit. The Moor takes out his scimitar and runs Petrushka through. It starts to snow and the little puppet dies." Joseph Pons returning to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Stravinsky's Petrushka.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Stravinsky leaving us with just the ghostly laughter of the puppet Petrushka at the end of his Shrovetide ballet. Joseph Pons conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra here at the Proms. The Symphony Orchestra led this evening by Simon Blendis. And we heard pianist Elizabeth Burley, principal flute Daniel Palethorpe, principal trumpet Gareth Finson. Timpanist was John Chimes, and I'm sure Joseph Pons will be picking out more players. That was the 1947 version of Petrushka, a slightly smaller orchestra than for the original 1911 score, the new arrangement allowing Stravinsky to benefit from copyright so he could capitalise on the popularity of the piece. Joseph Pons now bringing members of the orchestra to their feet. As I say, Daniel Palethorpe, the first to be brought to a standing position, followed by Gareth Vinson. Huge cheer for him. Giuseppe is a big favourite with the Symphony Orchestra players, a wonderful musician, a great lover of theatre music, currently music director at the Liceu in Barcelona. But that's all from the first of tonight's Proms. We're back here at 10:15, but for now let me hand you on to Ian Skelly.
Louise, thank you very much indeed. Louise Fryer at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. And if you'd like to hear that prom again, you can do so next Monday afternoon when it forms our Proms repeat programme in Afternoon on 3. That's next Monday from 2. Or, of course, if you have the internet, you can listen online anytime you'd like to for the next 7 days on the iPlayer Radio, which you can find on the Radio 3 website or the very easy to use and free to download app. Full details about that also on the Radio 3 website. So, yes, back to the Albert Hall in just under, 45 minutes' time for that late prom from Django Bates. He last appeared at the proms 26 years ago, so find out what's new at 10:15 tonight. And in between times, a chance to hear the composer of the piece receiving its world premiere at that first prom tonight, Andrew McGregor, in conversation with the German composer Charlotte Seiter in just a moment.
Tone poems by Richard Strauss, Bantok and Sibelius, live from the BBC Proms. I'm Christopher Cook. Join me as Vladimir Yurovsky and the London Philharmonic Orchestra trace the development of one of music's most flexible and imaginative forms. Friday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Well, later tonight on Radio 3, a form of music which has slowly but surely gained a reputation and indeed a standard, the music that accompanies video games, is given some high-profile attention in Late Junction this week with Nick Luscombe. He also features tracks from Aphex Twin, folk music from Nick Jones and much more besides. That's at 12:45 tonight after our late prom. But now, as I say, it's time for another Proms composer portrait, which actually took place earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music in London. It's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
Composer Charlotte Seiter tells us in the programme note that she's written for her new piece in this evening's prom that voices are wonderful. They're deeply rooted in the human soul and they always tell the truth. They never lie. What, Charlotte, never?
Yes, even if they lie, they tell the truth of lie.
I think you need to elaborate on that a little.
Yes, it's wonderful. I think that the voice is so deeply rooted to our emotions, so it's so difficult if you have a special emotion to hide it in your voice. And if you hear somebody who is hurt by something, the voice will tell it to you. And if he tries to convince you from something which is contrary to the real feeling, you can so often feel it as well in the voice, that the voice tries to play a theater or the voice tries to do anything which is the contrary from that. And I really like the way in which the voice is not changeable of a person, and it's so true related to the soul and to all the inner things which are important to say and which are important to feel.
And so this is the idea of the, well, I think you call it the shadow around a voice, which tells the truth regardless of what the words are actually saying.
Yes, yeah. We often have the words as well in the pieces we hear in the evening. The words tell something, but the voice is the truth, and not what is told in the words of voice. If I say I want to search for my words, and I do it in that language, in the sentence, I want to search my voice, of course it doesn't make sense. It makes sense to show a music in which the person tries to find the voice or to lose the voice or something like that. So I really make a big difference between the things which the text is saying in general and the things how the voice behaves. And I do not trust text at all. I only trust the music. I only trust the diction of the singer. I only trust the honesty of the voice as an instrument, of the voice as as part of human being.
The first piece we're going to hear also has, well, it does have a literary inspiration, doesn't it? Because you're setting a text from Kafka.
Yes, it was a commission for a Kafka festival where I was asked whether I would like to think about Kafka. And I said, yes, but give me time. I just want to think about whether I can get in a relationship with this author, because his language is so special. And even if German is your mother language, Kafka is extremely anti-musical in a special way, because he makes so long sentences and he has so a complicated structure of putting the parts of the sentence and the chromatic insight. So my first impression was Kafka is the one author which is the first which is impossible to work about. And then I thought that I would want to think what could be my solution. And I read a lot of texts of Kafka and I decided immediately it does not make sense to take a poem or to take any prose of him and to make a mimetic exegesis of this as a composer. It's more beautiful to take a fragment and to let it vibrate and to let this fragment circle inside of the head of the singer and to look what happens then. And so I used the text of Kafka, but I wouldn't say that these pieces are compositions about Kafka. It's my music and I use Kafka, but the things which then happen are not really the authentic Kafka. It's a transposition in something contemporary. It's the transposition in the head of a lady, in the head of a singer, in something which is a little bit more outside of Kafka, but meeting Kafka on another point.
And, well, the title, Mintzmeisel. I know Meisel is a chisel, isn't it? It's a sort of stonemason's chisel. Mint?
Yes. I invented this word. It doesn't exist. Kafka uses the word Hitzenagel, German, which doesn't exist in the German language as well. And it's an amalgamation of heat and nail.
Nail.
Yes. And he always had the idea in the text to feel the moment before a nail is treated inside your head and you just feel the fear, the incredible fear. So it doesn't happen. It's just the moment before.
And
only the moment before.
And I'll attempt to translate the text and then we need to get the players on and hear the piece for ourselves. So the text translates, I think, as felt at the temple as the wall feels the tip of the nail that will be driven into it. So let's hear the piece. And let's welcome our first performers to perform Mintzmeisel, three small songs for voice and piano by Charlotte Zeiter, Katrina Morrison, and Ed Cohen.
Fühlt es am der Schläfe, wie war ich wieder Hitzenagel, Hitze, Hitzenagel, Nagel. Hitze, 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 Hitzenagel, Nagel. Hitze, Nagel, 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 Nagel. Hitze, Hitze, Nagel, 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 Nagel. Hitze. Nagel, 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 Nagel. Nagel, Nagel, Nagel. War ich wieder, wieder. Nagel, Nagel. War ich wieder, wieder. Wieder, wieder.